Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintos.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. Today we're going to take a look at our food system. What do we eat? How do the choices we make affect the sustainability of our food source? Donna and I recently shared a really fine book called The Third Plate by a chef named Dan Barber. It's called The Third Plate, Field Notes on the Future of Food by Dan Barber. He is the executive chef at a wonderful place called Stone Barns, north of Manhattan in New York. To assist us with this discussion, and we'll have a wonderful talk with him, we're going to have special guest Fred Kirschman.
One of our local fellows.
Yes, Fred's an Ames resident. Well, and a...
As much as we can get him.
As much as we can get him, yes. He's also a farmer, an educator, a philosopher, and currently he's a board member of this wonderful place called Stone Barns.
He's the president of the board at Stone Barns. He's also the distinguished fellow at the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture.
So, welcome, Fred. Glad to have you on the show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Good.
Well, first of all, as a chef, I have to rave a little bit about Dan Barber, the author of the book, so that we get a perspective on really who he is. And we also have to say that, unlike most chefs, this is not a recipe book. Hallelujah, Dan. This is really a book about food. And another thing I like about it is, even though it's a book about food, it is not written by a food journalist. It is really written by somebody who is totally immersed in the food system, up to their elbows, in deep to their hip waders, and quite thoughtful. Dan is actually, Fred, I hope this is okay to mention on air, but I think you told me a story before Barack Obama was, he was elected, but he hadn't been inaugurated.
Right.
He had Dan come and cook for him. That's how Dan, I think Dan is like, first of all, I think he's the thinking man's and woman's chef. He's really, really, I think he's one of the best American and certainly one of the most articulate chefs on the planet. So Dan was apparently invited to go to Chicago and cook for the president-elect and his wife, and there were food conversations, right?
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, you know, Dan, of course, is always interested in the kind of philosophy and position that people operate out of. And he had asked at that time President-elect Obama what he thought about, you know, the future of farming and food. And Dan said that Barack Obama had such a visionary view of what needed to be done and what we needed to do to get the kind of food and farming system that Dan felt we needed. And then Dan asked him if when he got into the office of the presidency, was he going to promote some of these? And then he said that that Barack got very, what's the right term? He got very kind of engaged in his own internal feelings. And then he said, I can't do that, because if I were to take that on, it would become so controversial that it would take up all my time, and there's going to be a few other things I have to do as president.
Right. We were at the depth of that recession.
But then he pointed to Michelle. He said, but she can.
Woohoo! And we all know what that developed into. So
I think that's really amazing that food production is a controversial issue.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, it is.
Yes. Could you tell us a little bit more about this Stone Barns and what goes on? What is this? It's a barn made out of stone. Is there a farm there?
Yeah, and I'll try to make it a short story because it can be a long one. But there is literally a stone barn on the facility there, and that was built back in 1921. And as I understand it, when J.D. Rockefeller was still the head of the family, he went to Europe in 1920, and he saw these stone barns in Europe. And the stone barns are a quadrangle structure with an open courtyard in the center. And in Europe, the farm families lived in part of that structure. They had their chickens in another part, their dairy cows in another part, the pigs in another part. And so farmers could actually go gather the eggs, milk the cows, feed the pigs without ever going outside. And so apparently J.D. Rockefeller was so intrigued by this, he decided he had to have one. And one of the things that's not very well known about J.D. Rockefeller, he was a big proponent already back then of the Rockefeller families producing as much of their own food as possible from the Rockefeller estate. No, they had people helping them do that, obviously, but still they were producing most of their own food. And so he built a stone barn as a dairy barn. And so they were milking their cows and making their own cheese, et cetera.
Sigh.
And today stone barns is something different, not just the dairy.
Yeah,
okay,
so
you told me it's 80 acres, right? Which that neighborhood is quite large, actually.
Yeah. When
extravagant, almost.
Yeah, when J.D. Rockefeller died, then David Rockefeller became the head of the family. And David got married to a woman by the name of Peggy, and she had grown up on a farm. And as I understand it from the family, she told David when they got married that she wanted to continue to farm. And David said that was okay as long as it didn't lose money. and she was already very enamored with grass-fed animals, and so she decided to raise some grass-fed Simmental breeding stock because it would add value and wouldn't lose money. And then she used the stone barns then for her calving barns. So when her cows went into labor, she took them in there to birth out their calves. And she used the courtyard in the center of the stone barn for her auction sales because her breeding stock was apparently some of the best in the country.
Oh, yeah, so and they're people, beautiful.
Hmm. Yeah, people came from all over North and South America to buy her breeding stock. And then she died suddenly in 1996, and she and David had been very close. And so he always wanted to do something to memorialize her passion and her gifts. And so his oldest daughter, whose name is also Peggy, she came up with the idea, well, we've got this stone barn sitting here now, and it's empty. And if we don't do anything, it'll deteriorate over time. Why don't we refurbish it into a center for sustainable agriculture in my mother's memory and make that available to the public? And so that's what they did. And then David also said that it had to be, in addition to being a nonprofit facility for the public, it also had to have some income-producing activity so it wouldn't be a drain on his estate into perpetuity. And so that's when they decided to invite a chef to create a restaurant there, an upscale restaurant, because there wasn't one in the Westchester County area.
And Dan already had Blue Hill Restaurant in Manhattan.
That's
very,
right.
Very
That's
noted
right.
chef already.
Right.
So now there's Blue Hill Restaurant at Stone Barns.
Yeah. So he has both restaurants going now. Yeah. And so the really unique thing about it, from my perspective at least, is that there we are now sharing the same mission, the same facility. One a for-profit and one a non-for-profit, and that's a really exciting concept, and it's working out really well.
And for Dan, as a chef, it provides a real laboratory space, which I imagine is like a dream come true. It's like an 80-acre playfield for a chef because he really cooks from what is produced on the farm.
Yeah, he gets some. He also wants to work with other
and the
farmers,
air, and
but,
the region,
but
in, right.
the majority of the vegetables, et cetera, come right from the farm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we talk about food meters instead of food miles.
Oh,
well, and so let's get to the point of this book. Oops, that it's called The Third Plate, which means. You want to explain that, Fred?
Yeah. Well, the reason that Dan came up with it, you know, Dan has always been an incredible. A person of incredible interest, and he never gets engaged in anything without going to visit it. You know, for example, when he found that there was a farmer in Spain that was doing seafood in an ecologically sound way, he got on a plane and flew to Spain to visit the farmer and spend some time. And
he writes about it in the book.
Yeah. And as Dan was doing this, he gradually became aware of the fact that the way most of us think about food, we think about it in terms of our own particular place. You know, farmers are producers, processors are process the food, retailers are retailers,
and most of us are eaters.
Yeah, right. Yeah, we ultimately are eaters. But the longer that Dan especially as he visited farmers and found out what they had to face in order to produce the kind of food that he wanted. And he learned early on that, you know, his passion as a chef, of course, is to get the kind of food that has the most incredible flavor. And he found that the easiest way for a chef to get the kind of flavor in the food that the chef wants is to find farmers who are managing their soil for soil health.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the chef needs to do is prepare the food in a way that allows the natural flavors to express themselves. So he started to look for that and to find the farmers. His big passion then was find the farmers who were managing their soil in a way for soil health, and then he could buy food from them. And then eventually he began to, and he especially found...
Well, and this particular thing that Dan probably did earlier than most has become sort of the national trend of farm to table. So that would be what Dan would call the second plate.
Right, yeah. So the first plate is your industrial plate where, you know, you want your food fast, convenient, and cheap, et cetera. And the second plate is you want these qualities. You want it, you know, grass-fed or organic or whatever. And then Dan began to realize that that still wasn't where we needed to go because especially...
Right. We're not finished yet, folks.
he found this out, came to this awareness, especially when he started to buy some incredible quality of emmer wheat from Klaus Martin's farm on the north part of upstate New York. And so, again, he went out to visit Klaus, and as he visited Klaus, he discovered that Klaus had to grow cover crops in order to get that kind of quality wheat. He didn't get any income from the cover crops. He had to simply devote the land to cover crops to get the benefit from it. And he was also raising some other crops in the rotation, like barley and millet, which there was no sale for food crops for that, so he had to sell it as animal feed, so he didn't get very much income from that. And suddenly Dan began to realize that what he was really doing was cherry picking from his farm for just this one product that he wanted. Mm-hmm. And that was not, you know, and he refers in his book to Wendell Berry, who says the way we eat to a large extent determines the world we live in, right? And so Dan began to realize all of that. And so then he started to see, he came up with this concept, and this is what the third plate is about, and that is eating from the whole farm. How do you support the farmer in everything that the farmer needs to grow and produce in order to get this kind of quality of food that the chef wants? So then he started to recognize, for example, that some of those cover crops had the kind of leaf structure that you could use for salads in a restaurant. So he started to buy them. And
like the mustards, for example.
And right, the... yeah. And it doesn't harm the benefit which the cover crops provide for the soil, which you still have to have by simply harvesting those leaves off of it. He also began to realize that he could use some barley and some millet in some of the menus that he was going to serve in the restaurant. So now suddenly Klaus is starting to get some income from all of these things he has to do in order to produce that quality of emmer wheat that Dan wants. So that's really what the third plate is about, is eating from the whole farm. How do you develop those relationships with farmers so that you and the farmers will benefit from everything that they're trying to do, you know, to be responsible, ecologically responsible farmers.
And the farmer's obligation is obviously to support the soil.
Yes, right. Yeah, and it's, you know, that has some other, you know, you can talk about that in terms of, water quality. You can talk about it in terms of, sustaining the life of the soil and all of that. And you can talk about all of that as a sort of moral obligation, but, you know, if you don't get paid for that moral obligation, then, you know, especially the kind of economic constraints that most farmers operate under, you know, at some point we should understand and appreciate the fact that when farmers go for getting the best economic return, even though they don't provide these other things that we think they should be doing, then, we should at least have some sympathy for that.
Yes. Rather than telling the farmer that he should build his soil, we actually make it economically interesting for him and viable.
Right, yeah.
And I also read that this also has to do with livestock farming, using all of the animal, be aware of the whole aquaculture system, be aware of the whole food system.
Right. In the book, Dan talks about even using the bones – and charcoalizing them. Is that the right word?
Yeah, it's you can make biochar out of bones, and we do that at the Stone Barns. I mean, the bones from the meat come directly back to the farm, and then the farm turns them into biochar, mixes it with compost, and puts it back on the soil.
What's amazing about this, from what I've been reading, is that this is not just a laboratory and people kind of eking it out and making do with the bones. This is making delicious food with all of this stuff because everything is headed toward the best taste in all of it.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up the part about eating the whole animal, because that's also a part of the concept of the third plate. When you go to eat at the Blue Hill Restaurant, you don't get to choose from a menu.
No, it's a gastronomic education.
That's right, yeah. So the server will come to your plate, first of all.
You pay a lot of money to get this.
Yeah.
So you're not going to go, ooh, that risotto didn't taste the way. I mean, you are there because it's like going to a museum. It's a real education.
Yeah. And the server will come to your plate, to your table, and the first thing the server will ask, do any of you have any,
allergies
or other problems? And if you don't, then the server will say, well, okay, you know, what we're harvesting right now, you know, from the fields are such and such vegetables, and we have, some lamb available, we have some pork available, et cetera. What is it that you like? What do you like best? And then based on that conversation, the server goes back to the kitchen and provides that information to the chefs, and the chefs then put together the meal,
So it's a conversation.
Right.
It's
not just
the chef dictating.
Right, exactly. And you can choose between a 3-course meal or a 5-course meal or a 12-course meal. And
I'll take the 12 courses.
Yeah.
What a romp.
The other thing, and I've eaten there often enough now that I can testify to the fact that you would never eat a 12-course meal because, again, the nutrition of the food is so incredible that you feel satisfied much sooner than you do when you eat most food that you buy.
So it would be just one bite of each course then.
That's right, yeah.
Well, that sounds really like an adventure.
Yeah. But the meat, getting back to the meat is really from the whole animal. You know, you don't get a 7-ounce piece of steak. You get some cuts from the various parts of the animal. But again, the way it's prepared is just always incredibly delicious.
And this is not new. It's the old waste not, want not. I'm sure, Fred, when you were growing up, your mother didn't throw out the liver.
Yeah. My mother was a firm believer in everything but the squeal, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
and the chef as advocate, the chef as a leader of taste, we often forget that maybe most of us will not eat at a really fancy restaurant where you have even the Stone Barns, which has an amazing menu, but the prices are high, and many of us won't even get there. But chefs like Dan Barber do set the tone, just like designers of other things. It trickles down. It trickles down what we think is the proper way to eat like an American. The big steak and the potato, well, that looks good on the plate, so that was sold for quite a few years.
Yeah.
But there are other tastes. There are other amazing things that can be done. And it's wonderful to realize that people are out there tasting things, not just selling things.
Yeah. And I do need to also say, if anybody's going to New York and they want to eat at the Blue Hill, it's not cheap. I mean, this is definitely an upscale restaurant. But you also, if you know beforehand, and you know the 3-course meal is much, much cheaper than the 12-course meal, and you're going to be satisfied with the 3-course meal. So people need to get some information about it. But it's an incredible place. The other thing too is that, and Dan himself is concerned about people feeling like they can't get any benefit from what he's doing because the prices at the restaurant are too high. But
now you can buy the book.
Yeah,
it helps
well, this
a lot.
It's not just the book, but the chefs have regular courses at the Stone Barns where people can come and for a very small price, and they can even get scholarships and get the information for free, and you can learn everything that Dan's doing
and do that
at home.
Stone Barns has a whole website of courses, and it's an educational facility
right.
That's a fabulous opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of our major objectives at Stone Barns is to teach children. So we have about 10,000 kids that come through there a year now, and they range in age from 5 to 12, basically, and they learn all this stuff. And the reason that I feel very passionate about that is that I think that as we move into our future of higher energy costs, more climate change, et cetera, Richard Heinberg reminds us that by the year 2040, we're going to have 40 to 50 billion people engaged in producing our food. And so this generation of children growing up now, a lot of them are going to be growing their own food, and they're going to have all that information basically for free.
And you do a, speaking of grown-up children, you do a beginning farmers conference at Stone Barns?
That's the second major objective, yeah. It's the children and then the young farmers, so that farmers can we have 12 to 20 apprentices there every year. They learn about how to do farming this way on a day-to-day basis. And then we have an annual conference the first week in December so that, we can't provide apprentices for everybody, but we can but even the number of young people who want to come to the conference, we can't accommodate them all because the largest barn space that we have for the conference accommodates about 220 people, and we always sell out before, mm-hmm. So there's last year, for example, we had 170 young people who were on a waiting list hoping that some that had registered couldn't
Maybe
come.
Maybe they'll come this year.
Well,
I wanted to ask a few questions and talk about that. It's quite a long book, 500 and some pages or something like that. But I just raced right through it because I found it fascinating. First of all, he's a fabulously entertaining writer, which is marvelous.
Yeah. And a great storyteller.
Yeah, absolutely. and he talks about some of the parts that I think that are very relevant to Iowa, where he talks about small grains. Here's a little quote. He says, this is a quotation from another researcher whose research is on wheat and built something called the Bread Lab, which is what I want Fred to talk about a little bit. But he says, we know that the one-size-fits-all farm, the monoculture behemoth growing 10,000 acres of one variety of wheat, or we could say corn, we know that's passé. Well, we don't quite know that yet in Iowa, but there is a discussion about that. He says, the emerging paradigm, the future of this, is to grow wheat or corn locally, all over the place, in ridiculously small plots, hyper-local wheat, or I would also say hyper-local small grains. Yeah. And I think in Iowa, one of the things that we are beginning to explore in terms of cover crops is to try to change the corn bean corn rotation in ways that make our soil a little more erosion-proof, a little less nitrate loss, some of the major environmental problems that we're beginning to have or have been having for a long time. Some of this is the mandate of the Leopold Center to work with. So the main problem when you get into looking at cover crops is what do you do with them? Because we've lost our abilities to process anything in this in the Iowa, really, except for corn and soy. Like if you grow wheat, how do you clean the wheat? How do you mill the wheat?
Where do you sell it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Dan addresses some of this on a national level in the book, which I think is very interesting in terms of Iowa. And Fred, explain about the Bread Lab. I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah. Well, the quote that you quoted, of course, is from Steve Jones. And I've known Steve Jones for a long time, and he's primarily
– Fred is a wheat grower. Basically, first and foremost.
Yeah, it's one of the staples in North Dakota, my farm. But Steve Jones, he's been at Washington State University, and he has almost all of his career wanted to do some wheat breeding for quality and for differentiation. But of course, the market wants yield, right? So everything is about yield. So he's had to spend most of his life breeding wheat for yield. Now, understandably, that's not unimportant, but that wasn't what his passion was. But he began kind of on his own to be, and he was able to get some varieties of seed from, actually from the University of California, who'd had some in their seed bank, some of these heritage varieties. And so he went to University of California at one point and said, you know, are you willing to sell me some of this? And they said, if you want it, you can have it. It doesn't have any value for us. So he got all these varieties of heritage varieties of wheat seed, and then he started to plant those on small scale and began to discover some of the incredible quality characteristics for baking and other things that that kind of wheat had. And then farmers in the northwest corner of Washington State, they began to be interested in this. And so they started to grow some of that wheat. And it finally got to a point here a few years ago where the farmers were raising enough of that that they were willing to invest in building a processing plant to process this wheat and flour. And so then Steve started this whole new research facility to grow the wheat, to turn it into flour and a bake lab as well. And so so this has now become kind of a national treasure. And I told Dan Barber about Steve Jones. So, of course, again, Dan got on a plane, flew out to Washington State, met when he and Steve just got on really well together, and they're working together well now. And they were even, you know, here gives you an idea of how rapidly this is growing. John Deere has a regular monthly magazine called The Furrow. And one of the whole issues of The Furrow in March of, I think, 2013, if I remember right, was all about taste. And one of the articles in
there... Shocker!
One of the articles in there was all about Steve Jones and Dan Barber working together to develop this incredible taste. This was in John Deere magazine.
All right.
That's why this does sound like a revolution. We're actually talking about food that has some taste. You're listening to KHOI Radio. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Watch the field behind the plow. Turn to straight, dark roads. Feel the trickle in your clothes. Blow the dust cake from your nose and hear the tractor's steady roar. Oh, you can't stop now. There's a quarter section more or less to go. And it figures that the rain keeps its own sweet time. You can watch it come for miles, but you guess you've got a while. So ease the throttle out a hair. Every rod's a gain, and there's victory in every quarter mile. Poor old Kuzik down the road, the heartache hailed and hoppers brought him down. Gave it up and went to town. And Emmett Pierce the other day took a heart attack, died at 42. Well, you could see it coming on, 'cause he worked as hard as you. In an hour, maybe more, you'll be wet clear through. The air is cooler now. Pull your hat brim.
Hi, we're back. This is KHOI, the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking today with Fred Kircherman about the new book, The Third Plate, by Dan Barber. This is a wonderful book that explains a lot about the relationship.
Food and farming.
Food and farming, why things taste the way they do. And he does it with stories. It's a wonderful book to read, and you'll learn a lot. We're here with Fred Kircherman, and he's directly connected with food, not just because he's an eater, but because he's a large-scale grain farmer.
So Fred, who's also at the Leopold Center and the Stone Barn Center, takes his annual month of vacation to go and farm. Now, he just got back from his farm, and what did you find in North Dakota this year?
Well, it's been a very challenging year from a point of view of weather. First of all, we had one of the latest springs that we've had in a long time. We normally want to get our wheat and flax in the ground by the middle of April. This year, we finished seeding the third week in May because it had been so cold, and our rye started to sprout because we had a few, about a week of sort of warm weather. And then it turned back cold again, and it froze it.
Freeze dried rye in the field.
Yeah, right. So then, because it was so late, of course, harvest is late now. August almost always in North Dakota is a hot, dry period of time, so it's perfect for harvest. This year was just the opposite. The whole time that I was up in North Dakota, we had rain every day or every other day. We still have not started harvesting up there. As organic farmers, we windrow our wheat so that it has a chance to uniform. Because, North Dakota has... This is in central North Dakota. It's called the Prairie Pothole Region, and so there's hilly land. So wheat, of course, always ripens on the top of the hills before it does on the lowlands, and so then we windrow it so that it can dry uniformly. And we windrowed our rye 2 weeks ago, and like I say, it's been raining almost every day, and the rye has started to sprout now. So it's not going to be a usable crop at all. The wheat is still okay. And we finally got a few dry days. Steve went out yesterday. Steve is a person who's doing the day-to-day operations on our farm right now. He went out yesterday with the combine to kind of check on the moisture, and the moisture was still 17%. Well, it has to get down to 12% before it'll be, good for storage. And today is another sunny day, so he's hoping by the end of the day today he can maybe get some combining done. We can combine it at 15% moisture and put it into the bin and turn the fans on, and it'll get it down to
12%. It's like drying corn in that way.
Yeah, but it's drying without without propane. But if that doesn't happen, we may have to run it all through the propane dryer. That's going to be additional cost. And the reason I mention all of that is because I think that not only farmers, but most of us are not really yet taking seriously the impact of climate change. And these extremes in weather, more floods, more droughts, more severe weather events are probably what's going to be the new normal for the future.
Let's draw a little thread here and go back and tell us how you develop the particular seed that you plant on your ground year after year.
Oh, and also, who eats this seed? Who eats this wheat?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. That's always, all of that's been an evolving process, that I'm sure you can imagine. We started to convert our farm to an organic farm back in 1976. And in my life, most of these things are simply things that happen. They weren't things I planned for. And I learned about organic farming from a student of mine when I started my career in higher education. And I was impressed by the research that the student had done in terms of quality of soil. And it doesn't mean that everybody who's farming organically has good quality soil, because you can get certified organic today simply by only using natural inputs instead of synthetic inputs, so you don't have to pay attention to the quality of soil. But if farmers who really pay attention to the beginnings of organic understand that quality soil is foundational to what I would at least call true organic production. Mm-hmm. So I went back to the farm in 1976 and worked with my father.
And your father was still, yeah.
Yeah, and he was excited about doing it because, my father started farming in 1930, which was still in the wake of the Dust Bowl, so he understood about the importance of taking care of land. And so then we started to – we used the variety of wheat that was available commercially, and then because we were continually
saving our own seed from our own
harvest, and because of the kind of quality of soil that kept improving, The germination quality of the wheat kept improving. So we've never had to
So the
bring
seed
it in,
adapted
you
know,
so,
to...
So this seed that we're using now is at least 35 years old, and it still has good germination quality.
So then what will happen to the evolution of the seed adaptation process if the weather dramatically changed? How will the seeds that you've been growing for this long work with the new... if we keep having more wet weather, for example?
Well, that's the mystery that we have to deal with now. See, this
right.
is why I think one of the things that our universities and extension, cooperative extension people, et cetera, should begin to address is how can we start to anticipate the changes that are coming at us and how do we adapt to those changes? And it isn't just the seed. It's, you know, it's everything. You know, like now we as I said, we can't harvest yet because it's so much water. So how do we do that? Well, one of the things that we do know that works on our farm is the animal part of our operation did pretty well through this whole period of time because
lots to eat.
About 800 acres of our farm is still in native prairie. The native prairie is doing fine. Native prairie also does pretty well during drought conditions because they have
it's
this deep
root system.
It's very
adaptable, isn't
right,
it, that
right,
native
yeah.
prairie? Gosh and golly.
Now, does that mean we should go to all animals on our farm and all, you know, perennial grasses? I don't know. But you know, one of the other things that is happening, and, you know, Wes Jackson has been working with perennializing varieties of grain.
That's right.
And you have those deep, you know, a perennial grain, the root system will go 18 feet into the soil instead of about 18 inches, so it has all of those benefits from the soil that it can capture from that depth. So, you know, we've still got, and Wes knows this, we've still got more research to do and more adaptability on all of the development of these perennial grains. But we'll get there if we keep doing this. So if we go to... And the other thing is that, you know, you had mentioned earlier cover crops, and we now know from farmers who have been doing cover crops, and we've done some research on cover crops at the Leopold Center, but farmers who have been doing cover crops for, including, say, cover crops in a typical corn-soybean rotation for 6 to 7 years, they can reduce their fertilizer and pesticide input by 70%, still maintain their yields, and the quality of their soil improves to a point where instead of our soils only absorbing about a half inch of rainwater an hour, which is about where most of our soils are now, the soil starts absorbing 8 inches of rainwater an hour.
Which is a good thing. We had five inches of rain this week.
Yeah. If the soil is absorbing so much more water, you have less damage from flooding, and you have that water stored in the soil for the drought periods, which is going to sustain it more. And the thing that's interesting now, and the Natural Resources Conservation Service now, especially through people like Ray Archuleta, have become big advocates of cover crops. And so increasingly, farmers are beginning to recognize not just, you know, these moral benefits that we talked about, mm-hmm. but the economic benefits.
Well, and that's what Dan wants the chefs and
that's
the
right.
eaters to do.
Right,
and
exactly.
Eat
yeah.
those cover crops.
Yeah, yeah.
This, and also this wonderful conversation between the eaters, the cookers, and the farmers. We're not just concerned, or we shouldn't just be concerned about quantity, about yield. We're talking flavor, folks. We're human
right.
beings.
Well, and
flavor.
Nutrition.
And nutrition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to benefit the person eating actually very profoundly. When you remineralize your soil, that goes into the food. Yeah. There's a lot of speculation in health and medical circles that one of the problems is we are nutrition deficient. Even though we're eating larger quantities of food, the actual mineral and nutrient density in our food is so diminished that we're kind of starving our fat little selves.
Yeah. The amazing thing here is that we've had people of wisdom from the past that understood this a long time ago. Sir Albert Howard, for example, who he wrote two books, one in 1940 and one in 1947. His first book was called An Agriculture Testament, in which he made this case for the quality of soil as being foundational to everything else. And then he wrote a second book called The Soil and Health, in which he pointed out he had drawn the conclusion that if you didn't have healthy soil, you couldn't have healthy plants or healthy animals and therefore healthy humans. Mm-hmm. And that he said, was all one topic. And this, he said, was going to be the healthcare system of the future. Now, we haven't done any peer-reviewed research that I'm aware of, at least, to make this case, to in fact prove this is true. But there's now an increasing number of people, especially in the healthcare profession, who are recognizing this. Mm-hmm. Because, mm-hmm. you know, our healthcare system now is costing us 18% of our GDP. And healthcare professionals, who are some of my friends that I'm talking to, they're telling me that if we don't do anything different, it'll go to 25% of GDP by the year 2040.
And plus we'll be really uncomfortable all along the way because we will not be feeling very well.
That's right. So you have the increasing those increasing healthcare costs and
quality of life.
And so there are now people like Daphne Miller, for example, who is a family practitioner in California. She's written a book now titled Pharmacology, not P-H-A-R, but F-A-R. And she's looking at the relationships between agriculture and healthcare. You've got people like Bob Lawrence, who has spent most of his career at the Center for a Livable Future at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. He's been convinced that these connections between soil and food and health are critical to our future healthcare system. And he's devoted all of his career now to this. And so there are now a number of people. I even have met a physician in New Jersey who has a family practice, and he has worked with his community, and they've now put together a farm of, I think, 230 acres. He grows all of the food for his healthcare profession from his farm.
For his patients?
Right.
And he, and fabulous.
The moniker that he's put together is that that food is health or food is medicine.
Yeah.
I think Andrew Weil has been writing about that for a long time. And he's been demonstrating that it works. I mean, the people mm-hmm. that are his patients are, you know, as a group are healthy. And some that have some of the older people, like his father, in fact, came down with pancreatic cancer. And he put him on a very strict diet from these you know food products that he thinks are critical. And his father has now survived 5 years. I think he said after 3 months the pancreatic cancer tumor started to shrink. Now, again, I'm not saying that's the solution to everything, but there are these connections between soil and food and health.
Kaiser Permanente in California, which is one of the largest HMOs
right,
in the world,
right.
has really been finding that
yeah. Yeah.
They can reduce costs. It's good business to feed people healthy food
right,
because
right, yeah.
people are healthier. That
yeah,
reduces
yeah,
their costs
yeah,
in
yeah,
terms
yeah,
of providers.
Yeah, yeah, but we need to do some more real peer-reviewed research on all of this to establish it. I mean, you know, so far it's basically anecdotal evidence, which is not that
all right,
that's
so
unimportant. But
what industry would pay for that? Maybe the insurance industry.
Well, I think that and with the Affordable Care Act now, of course, part of what they're trying to do in that is to make sure that, you know, insurance companies don't overcharge in order to stay in business. But to there's at least an underlying emphasis there on changing the system to maintain the health of individuals.
Oh,
and there's some authors that I've read now that, in fact, say we don't have a health care system. We have a sickness care system.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
you wait until people get sick, and then you put all of your energy and your effort and your funding into getting them well again as opposed to keeping them well to begin with. So that's a shift we have to make.
There's a quote that I ran across a couple times in the book. It was referring to the Mennonite culture, and they asked the question, when do you start raising a child? And the answer for them is not when the child's born. It's 100 years before because you've made
yeah.
the society and the yeah. farm and right. the food.
Yeah.
You are preparing the seed,
right.
preparing the ground
right. yeah.
for what you're doing.
Yeah.
We have to realize we are part of this.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So everything is part of everything else. Wonderful.
Yeah.
Good. Well, we've been talking about the book, The Third Plate by Dan Barber, with Fred Kirchman.
We're back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen on KHOI Community Radio 89.1 FM. We've been talking about eating from the farm, cooking with the whole farm. There's so much good stuff out there. And on the Donna Lana Kitchen, Donna often, almost every time this summer has brought us a good treat of the week.
Oh, the cold treat of the week. Okay, guys, this one is really, really simple. Remember 2 nights ago when we were having our hugely exciting downpour? I mean, at my house, the curtains were flapping in the breeze and the screen doors were banging. And, I mean, it was a glorious symphony. And it was a Saturday night. I didn't feel like going out. I mean, it was drenching. Downpouring, yeah. Everything.
I've heard that referred to as a toad strangler.
A toad strangler. Oh, I like that. I like that. All right, Lana. So what am I doing that night? You know, I wanted to make pudding. So pudding is the cool treat of the week. It is the ultimate comfort food. So here I am waltzing around the kitchen with the curtains flapping, and I'm making pudding. Now, normally I like to make chocolate pudding. But it was, you know, I thought, all right, with this storm, if I make chocolate, I'm going to keep myself up all night. So I just gave up and I made vanilla pudding because that's what I had in the house. Eggs, milk, cornstarch. I'm going to encourage you to just look it up in The Joy of Cooking. I just used her basic recipe and then I ate it with the ripe Colorado peaches. So I have to say that Hy-Vee has delicious Colorado peaches at an extraordinary price. Hop on down and get them. The fact that our own produce, our fruit has been so waterlogged this year, like I was picking elderberries and they're, you know, as soon as they're ripe, they fall off the plant. And the raspberries I picked from my garden yesterday, which were the first of the season, were waterlogged. You know, it's just like, so the Colorado peaches, yes, they're really, really good. And also, I have to give a shout out. It's the beginning of apple season. We're getting some fabulous apples from Berry Patch. And mercifully enough, the apples look great this year. So we're going to be eating a lot of apples. And that's the cool treat of the week is pudding, the ultimate comfort food. I have to say that it was 4 cups of milk. I have to say that I probably ate half of the pudding that night.
And well, you should have, after all.
Yes, comfort food. Pudding. Now,
and also, we had a nice recipe idea from a Donna Lana Kitchen supporter.
Oh, yes.
See, she suggested, now get this, folks, coffee ice cream with Sierra Nevada Porter beer.
Yeah, this is our theme. We've been going along with the beer floats. So this was another suggestion was coffee ice cream and Sierra Nevada Porter. Someone else told me their favorite is vanilla ice cream with an IPA. So, look, we got a lot of experimenting to do,
yes.
Lana.
Good. So thank you, Sarah, for that. And I guess we just have to test some more of this stuff out. It'll be good. All right. I want to mention some upcoming events coming up in September. PFI has field days. Practical Farmers of Iowa has field days. You can go out and meet your farmer, meet your farm. In September, there is a field day on organic dairying and cattle care at Bloomfield, Iowa. I'll give you the website for this later. There's a field day on community-based farm startups in Tama, Iowa. And these field days are visit the farm, talk to people who know what they're doing. Be wonderful. There's also on Saturday, September 13th, compost heat capture for high tunnel season extension. It's some work that Rick Schuler has been doing on Tabletop Farm. That's on the 13th. And
For you engineering types, that will be wonderfully interesting.
Yeah, they're using heat from compost to heat greenhouses. What a good idea. And on a reminder, we mentioned this earlier in the year, Sunday, September 21st, There's a Macon Bacon pork processing, curing, and tasting.
I'm going to that one.
At the Story City Locker.
Story City Locker.
Yes, that has got Bobby and Ty Gustafson from Story City Locker, Kathy and Herb Eckhaus from LaCrescia, and Tom and Irene Franzen from Franzen and Family Farm. So learn about how your pork chop happens.
This combination of producers is it's going to – they're the best of the best. It's going to be great.
So to find out more about Practical Farmers and these field days, go to www.practicalfarmers.org.
Can I add one to your list, which is relevant to our conversation? And I can't help but notice your T-shirt, Lana, with the Earth Without Art is just E-H. So Earth is E-A-R-T, Art H, right? And one of the other events that's going to be taking place at the end of the month in September, I think it's 29th and 30th, is the annual PESIC lecture, which this year is all about soil.
Who's coming?
Well, there's a soil scientist that's coming whose name I've forgotten at the moment. Oh. But also Deborah Kunz Garcia is going to come back and show her Symphony of Soil again with a conversation.
So this will be in the –
It'll be here
at ISU.
Yeah, it'll be here at ISU.
Okay.
Right, yeah. And the reason I link that to art is because the Symphony of Soil is one of the most artistic expressions of soil
that we have. It is a beautiful
movie. And nobody can sit through the Symphony of Soil and still think that soil is just dirt. And it's an example of the role that the arts can play in helping us to imagine some of the things we need to be thinking about for the future.
That's a wonderful connection, yes. And one more thing coming up. There's a farm cruise September 13th from 10 to 4. They're going to be visiting farms around the Central Iowa area, Berry Patch, Tabletop Farm, Corey Farm, Seven Pines Farm, and the new Family Farm. You can find out more about that by going to farmcruise.com. So you've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Donna Priskintis, Lana Noctigal, and excellent engineering by Rick Morrison.
And thank you, Fred Kirschemann.
Yes, we've been talking about the book Third Plate. We'll go out with some music by the Barn Owl Band. We've been listening to the Barn Owl Band live CD through this whole show. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Visit us at khoifm.org. You can find us on the archives there. We're on Tuesdays at noon. You can hear us again in the evening, Tuesday at 7 p.m. So, eat good food and enjoy life.